From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Biden introduced a sweeping immigration bill today that includes an 8-year pathway to becoming a citizen. Tomorrow, the administration is set to begin processing the cases of asylum seekers who were affected by former President Trump's migrant protection protocols, also known as the Remain in Mexico policy. But two of the three designated ports are in Texas, where rolling blackouts and a lack of water have brought the state to a near stop. So it's unclear what's really going to happen to the cases. Charlene DeCruz is a lawyer in Brownsville, Texas, who's been helping asylum seekers living in the Matamoros migrant camp in Mexico that's right on the other side of Brownsville. She's also the director of Project Corazon, part of Lawyers for Good Government. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Lisa.
Do we know right now if the process is even going to work tomorrow? Are the ports in Texas going to be able to open as planned?
I believe that our ports are not going to open tomorrow. It is my understanding that there are no people actually getting through the Matamoros, Brownsville port tomorrow. But the registration process that the U.S. government has with the UNHCR will open. What they are expecting is that there be a slow opening, especially, I think, given the weather in Texas.
And who are we talking about that is affected by this? Who's being allowed to register?
The people in phase one, so people who have their an asylum case that's still pending before the immigration judge and have not had a final order of deportation and who've been in the MPP program. I believe the phase one start will be people who've been in the program the longest. So in Brownsville, Matamoros, MPP came to Brownsville in mid-July, I believe, of 2019.
The Department of Human Services new secretary has said that the administration is prioritizing 25,000 cases of the estimated 68,000 asylum seekers who were sent back to Mexico. For those who did not sign up for this program, are they returned to their home countries? What happens with them?
First of all, unfortunately, asylum seekers didn't have a say in being put into this program. This protocol was forced onto them. What happened is when people were put into the program, they were forced back into Mexico. One thing that happened was people went into these court hearings on the border. Of the people who came early in the system, at least in Matamoros, had their hearings already. If they were denied and they did, and their appeals were denied, they're out of luck right now because they don't fall in this phase one category of paroles. So the way this the paroles are working is there's a it's three phases, and the phase one is if you have an active case either with the immigration judge or on appeal, and now 40-something thousand people who have suffered under MPP are not getting a chance, at least not in phase one. There are negotiations about phase two, but they're in the future. So for the folks who are getting in, the 25,000, those are only people who still have an open case.
And what is the condition that these people are facing in Mexico, the Matamoros camp that's right on the border with Brownsville, where you are now? It's been cold all throughout the region. There are migrants there, somewhere around 1,000 right now. What kind of conditions are they living in?
I've been on the ground in Matamoros since September 2019. The conditions have always been horrendous. It is worse now. They got snowed on. And so the conditions have been hard. It's been extremely cold. There's not enough blankets. There's not enough heaters. And then the cold also cut out, I think, one heater. So the conditions are really rough. They have been getting worse over the COVID era, you know, and now with this. I have been working very closely with people with disabilities and medical vulnerabilities. Since the new administration has come in, I've been pushing for paroles off those folks because for over 10 months, we've been strapped. We have been not able to get anyone across. So I've been trying to get people across who are, you know, really vulnerable. But everybody right now is vulnerable, and the situation is really dire.
And what are they saying, your clients? What are they telling you about the process? I mean, they've been waiting so long already and have to wait even longer now.
Yeah. As you might imagine, asylum seekers are very patient people. Many of them who are qualifying in this first phase are ecstatic. They're ecstatic because they see the end coming up. Yes, they have to wait a few more maybe months, who knows. But they're also devastated that it's going to take, you know, another amount of time, and then the weather slammed them. And you have to remember that in June we had a hurricane. So, you know, we're basically like going from one national disaster to another. Mm. And they're all nervous, and they're frightened that they're going to be taken advantage of, that there's going to be people coming across. And there's already been a lot of misinformation being passed by people. We have an amazing coalition on the ground here and across the border that we've been meeting to try to get the administration to work with us. And the administration has been open to working with us, but we have some amazing humanitarian groups and lawyers, and we're scrambling to keep the information out there that's correct.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. Charlene DeCruz, Director of Lawyers for Good Government, and a lawyer who's helping asylum seekers in Brownsville, Texas. Thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you, Lisa.
Well, in addition to working on those asylum cases along the U.S. southern border, the Biden administration has also promised to increase the number of refugees accepted into the United States. That's after the Trump administration dramatically cut the number to 15,000. The lowest since the refugee settlement program began in 1980. Earlier this month at the State Department, President Biden said he is raising that cap to 125,000, not far from where it was when former President Obama left office.
It's going to take time to rebuild what has been so badly damaged.
It's also going to take some time for the refugee resettlement network to reassemble itself, from camps around the world to caseworkers in places like Cleveland, Ohio. Here's WCPN IdeaStream's Nick Castile.
Mayal Degal Gemba says that many people in his Congolese community in Cleveland have been waiting for family who were supposed to join them here, only to have their journeys put on hold. The Trump administration's slowdown in refugee admissions created a bottleneck in the application process. Gemba describes it as a nightmare.
So many of us who came here as refugees and still had families that are in the process, who we hoped, you know, that were supposed to be joining and couldn't join due to some of the reckless orders that were made by the administration.
It's been a problem not just for families who fled conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but also for those affected by the now lifted Trump ban on travel from some majority Muslim countries. Gemba says the Biden administration will now face a huge task in preparing for a wave of new arrivals.
We are hoping to see actually a major shift, hopefully a major shift with this administration.
But that major shift can't happen right away. With fewer refugees coming the last 4 years, resettlement nonprofits have cut back. Brian Upton is the director of the Cleveland-based service organization Building Hope in the City. He goes so far as to say the refugee system was dismantled for 4 years.
And it cannot go back to running at 60 miles an hour like it was running in 2016. It's going to take time for the resettlement system here in Cleveland and across the country to be rebuilt.
In Cleveland, Catholic Charities cut the number of caseworkers who are the first point of contact for refugees from 5 down to 1, says Tom Morosco, who directs the Office of Migration and Refugee Services. Local refugee advocates say the number of resettlements in Cleveland fell from about 850 in 2016 to 200 last year. Nationally, admissions fell from about 85,000 to under 12,000 over that period. As Biden increases admissions, Morosco says placement agencies need time to catch up.
I don't want it to be too slow, but I want it to be appropriate so that way the staffing is there, that the schools are prepared. But we expect that the numbers are going to increase. And I would imagine year to year over the next 4 years that that number will substantially increase.
Resettlement agencies don't just have to add staff. They need to rejuvenate old relationships with employers and landlords who offered refugees jobs and housing in the past. Again, Tom Morosco.
We have to connect with landlords again who might have had really good relationships with us, but because we didn't fill some of their vacancies with refugees, have gone on to other tenants.
As refugees have been waiting, Cleveland has been changing. Affordability is a growing concern as rents and home prices rise on the city's near west side, home to many refugees. COVID-19 creates more complications. Neighborhood Family Practice, a community health center, has had to retool the hours-long health screenings it offers to newly arrived families, replacing some in-person time with telemedicine.
And I think we might have to change things further as we're adapting to bigger numbers.
Joanna Lynch is the Associate Medical Director for Refugee Health Services there. She says it may take up to 3 months to get new families in for their screenings.
We just need more space, more capacity, more resources at that point.
There are a lot of hopes riding on these changes. Glory Brissett resettled in the United States more than a decade ago. She hopes more people will have the chance she had to start a new life here after leaving behind tragedy in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The people who need second chance to survive for their lives, they can get those opportunity to be here. That's what I see is going to change.
For Here and Now, I'm Nick Castell in Cleveland.
Out this month is a book that takes a communal look at a history that has long been buried. 400 Souls collects the work of 90 writers, historians, poets, journalists, novelists, and activists to tell the story of Black Americans from the arrival of the White Lion, which brought slaves to the colonies in 1619, to the Black Lives Matter movement. Here's an excerpt of a chapter written by Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones on the arrival of the White Lion.
The story of the White Lion is classically American. It is a harrowing tale, one filled with all the things that this country would rather not remember, a taint on a nation that believes above all else in its exceptionality. The Adams and Eves of Black America did not arrive here in search of freedom or a better life. They had been captured and stolen, forced onto a ship, shackled, writhing in filth as they suffered and starved. Some 40% of the Angolans who boarded that ghastly vessel did not make it across the Middle Passage. They embarked not as people, but as property.
Scholars Ibram Kendi and Keisha Blaine are the editors of 400 Souls, and they join us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Ibram, I know that leading up to the 400th year, you had been thinking a lot about this. That it's basically the symbolic birthday for Black America. And you were thinking about how to take that on in a way that could live beyond the actual year. How did you come up with this idea of using multiple voices to tell these stories? You call them a community choir.
I wanted to figure out a way in which a creation, a product, a book could not only write history, but be history. And the more that I thought about it, the more I realized, well, what if we brought together a community who would write that history, but then 100 years from now, 200 years from now, people looking back at the 400th year would be able to say, well, this is what Black folks were thinking and even remembering at the 400th year mark. And so that's why we're so proud of 400 Souls, because it doesn't just write this 400 year history, it actually makes history.
Mm. These chapters that each writer takes on are over a few year period, some of them just a page or two, but together they make up what is the first single volume history of Black folks that we know of. Keisha, you two set out together on this quest. What was this process like for you to sit so deeply with these volumes about real people who helped shape our country? I mean, these are stories that in many cases have been denied for a very long time.
You're absolutely right. I think it was really a moving experience, just going through the process of working with the authors and reading the pieces. And even though we're both professional historians, I think we were equally surprised by some of the narratives that the writers wrote, because what's amazing about history and certainly about Black history is that there are always new stories to uncover. And the writers were able to center just a diverse array of historical figures, and they grappled with so many topics that remain relevant to understanding American politics. So it was a moving experience and certainly an exciting one, an opportunity to bring together a community to tell the history of a community.
One place where history is murky is in the telling of stories of Black people who were enslaved, which means many of these stories in this book will be new to readers. I mean, stories of rebellion beyond Nat Turner, stories of resilience. But more than anything, they really showcase the humanity of Black people. For instance, in the chapter Slave Market from 1714 to 1719, writer Sasha Turner details how enslaved Black children in New York were frequently sold to neighbors and friends, to business associates, because there was a different calculation on labor than in the South.
The type of structure that Keisha and I instituted for this book, where you had 80 writers write 5 years each of African-American history, amounting to 400 years, what that resulted in is the bulk of the book, nearly 250 years of it, being a narrative or stories when Black people were enslaved. And I wanted to emphasize that because typically that's not how it's done. You know, we want to get past slavery quickly and then sort of talk about Reconstruction and the history up to this day. And so in a way, we had so much space to tell the stories of Black people over and over again. And you just learn from those stories that these writers told that these people were deeply human, and that was that humanity that was pushing for their freedom.
Hmm. Keisha, you touched on this, but there is definitely a through line in bringing the past to the present, meaning we can clearly see in so many ways how these past events show up in the present. I mean, this sounds like it was intentional. It wasn't just a byproduct of putting together this collection.
You're absolutely right. It was intentional. And in fact, when we gave instructions to each author, as they were just in the very beginning of crafting their essays, we made it clear to them that we wanted them to grapple with the specific five-year period, but to also be thinking about how the particular topic connects to the present moment. And even when a writer does not explicitly talk about, 2020 or 2019, it's clear that they are thinking about how the history shapes the present moment. And we wanted each essay to connect with the reader in a powerful way. And that was just one way to do it, was to make sure that each author thought carefully about past and present as they were writing.
Mm-hmm. They're the traditional chapters of written text that is divided into 10 parts, and each part concludes with a poem. Ibram, you all knew very early on that you wanted to have poets to write poems. Why was it important to have poetry in this collection?
Well, you know, as you shared earlier, in many ways, this community of writers and their many individual voices, you know, came together as almost like a choir. And of course, if you're going to have a choir, you got to have some soloists. And so in many ways, the poets really served as those soloists at the end of every 40-year period, where they were able to really take those 40 years and really recapture them in verse in all their sort of complexity. And so we just thought it was important, you know, to have that. And as Keisha always sort of explains it, in many ways, it gives readers, you know, a break to even reflect, you know, on what they have read through the poetry.
Mm-hmm. You know, I asked Keisha what the process of producing this book was like for her, but I want to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Ibram, how has editing this book changed you?
I am just sort of amazed by just the incredible creativity and brilliance of Black writers. And it just really, you know, I think by working with so many writers on the same project, it just reinforced the beauty and brilliance. And so I have been changed in the sense because if I entered into this product just loving the writing community that I was a part of, you know, now it's like I can't be disconnected from it because I'm just so over the moon about, about the writers and the contributors of this text.
What about you, Keisha?
Well, the book really captures beautifully the power of community. And I was reflecting on this a lot, particularly around March, you know, in the process of putting the book together and editing the pieces. Every single one of us, I think, just had our lives turned upside down. with COVID-19. And I remember just those few weeks of being at home and not having access to my office, not being able to go anywhere, and feeling a sense of loneliness, which I think many of us felt, but working on the project at that same time and knowing that I was part of this larger community, it just gave me, I think, strength. And it was emotional to think about it, because here we were going through such a painful moment individually and collectively as a nation. But the project was in many ways a lifeline. And so it just transformed my thinking about community. I've always valued community, but now we were able to come together and reveal to the world that you can tell a powerful story about Black history, but wow, look what happens when you bring 90 brilliant Black writers together to tell that history. It's truly magical.
Hmm. Keisha Blaine and Ibram X. Kendi are the editors of the new collection, 400 Souls. Thank you all so much for your work in this conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, going forward a few centuries in this book, cultural critic Bakari Kitwana writes in his essay, The Hip Hop Generation, about the emerging hip hop political voice of the 80s and the significance of groups like Public Enemy, known for their socially conscious lyrics, like this song, Bring the Noise, which samples the words of Malcolm X.
Yo, Chuck, you study dribbles and still front on us. Show them that we can do this, because we always do this. Yeah, boy.
Bass, how low can you go? Death row, what a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal beast. Public Enemy number one. 5-4 said freeze, and I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun? But it's the wax that the Terminator X-bun. Now they got me in a cell, took my records, they sell. Cause a brother like me said, well.
To read an excerpt of 400 Souls, a community history of African America, 1619 to 2019, go to hereandnow.org. And a special thanks to Penguin Random House Audio for providing us the sound of Nicole Hannah-Jones's reading of Arrival.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
One of the premier science fiction writers of the 20th century, Octavia Butler imagined worlds that were radically different and strikingly similar to the one we live in today.
For our Black History Month special series, The Cautionary Tales and the Reasons for Hope that Octavia Butler left us.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Members of the House Financial Services Committee are grilling key players involved in the GameStop trading saga last month. Lawmakers want to find out if there was market manipulation behind the surge in GameStop shares, a surge fueled by Reddit. For more, we're joined by MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Lisa.
The CEOs of Reddit, Citadel, Melvin Capital, and the trading app Robinhood are all testifying today. What do lawmakers want to know, and what are they hearing back?
Well, there are a few particular goals here. The first one is they want to figure out what exactly happened. What happened to GameStop? And there were other stocks involved, but GameStop is the one we know the most about. What happened on the trading platform, Robinhood? What happened to GameStop? How did these big hedge funds that were invested both in Robinhood and in these distressed stocks, what did they do behind the scenes? Who lost and who gained? So that's part of the effort is fact-finding. The other matter is, what happened to average traders, and what, if anything, should be done to regulate how this kind of thing happens again to protect regular investors? Because what happened here is it was so-called retail investors, regular people who have a different job, who were most involved in this winning and losing. So I think legislators want to understand, is this something we should be regulating better than we currently are?
So the reason stock prices for GameStop rocketed so quickly had to do with something called a short squeeze. Could you tell us what that is and how the process of short selling can be more transparent?
Yeah. So let's say you invest $200 in a stock. The most you can lose is $200, right? If that stock goes to zero. That's called long investing. Short investing is that the stock's 200 bucks and you are betting that it's going to go down. So you borrow the stock from someone and you sell it, and then you've got to get that stock at a lower price. So let's say the stock goes down. You have already sold it, but you didn't own it, so you borrow it. Now, that works if the stock actually goes down. What happens if that stock starts going up? You now have to buy that stock at a higher price. So it's working against you, and the amount you can lose is actually endless. When a $200 stock goes to zero, all you can lose is $200. When a $200 stock goes to $2,000, you have to keep buying that stock in order to replace the stock that you borrowed. Here's the trick. The more people who have to buy that stock, the higher the stock goes. So a short squeeze is when a stock that was supposed to go down starts going up, and it goes higher and higher and higher and higher while investors are trying to catch that stock. And that's what happened in the case of GameStop.
And how can the process be more transparent then?
Well, it's not clear. The Securities and Exchange Commission, according to Dodd-Frank, the law that came in 2010, they're required to collect information about how much a company's stock has been sold short. In other words, how much is a company betting against how much are investors betting against a company? So in the case of the stocks that were involved here, GameStop or American Airlines or other companies, there tend to be distressed companies that investors are betting will go down. And the SEC tries to monitor that to figure out that people aren't gaming the system. But I don't think we know enough fully yet, and we may after the hearing today, about what part you'd actually fix if you were going to fix it. Often, lawmakers have these hearings, and there's, you know, it's sort of a publicity thing, but we're not quite sure what the there is. What part can you actually fix about this? And we're hoping to find that out this afternoon.
Okay, thank you. And we know you'll be watching it for us. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Thanks, Ali.
Thank you.
Okay, think about your favorite song. You're probably thinking about the singer's voice or the melody or maybe the backbeat. But what about the crisp sound of the recording? Legendary audio equipment inventor Rupert Neve was instrumental in that regard. His pioneering innovations are responsible for shaping the sound of recorded music in the 20th century and beyond. Neve died earlier this month at the age of 94, and we want to take a moment to remember his legacy with Susan Rogers, a professor at Berklee College of Music who worked as a record producer and studio engineer for Prince, Bare Naked Ladies, David Byrne, and more. Susan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk about Rupert Neve and be part of the program.
Yes, thank you for being here, Susan. One of Rupert Neve's best-known products is the Neve 8028 soundboard. Foo Fighters frontman Dave Grohl made that board the star in his documentary about the Los Angeles recording studio Sound City. Here he is speaking to NPR in 2013.
The Neve boards were considered like the Cadillacs of recording consoles. They just kind of look like they're from the Enterprise in Star Trek or something like that.
For those of us who aren't audiophiles, what purpose does this soundboard serve when recording an album? How does it shape the sound?
With a recording console, you're using that tool to sculpt the sound that is giving you the subtext in the musical story. So in the case of the Neve, I agree with Dave Grohl 100%. It was like a Cadillac. It had the thicker, fatter, warmer low end that was really hard to achieve. In the old days, Neve was building consoles that used individual components, which means that the auditory signal path had more room to travel. It was like a superhighway. So when you run your audio, your sound sources, whether it's your drums, your bass, your vocals, your horns, your piano, your strings, when you run it through a Neve console or any discrete console like that, you're going to pick up more information. Lower lows, higher highs. Things are going to breathe like the exhale of a singer's voice. You're going to be able to capture all that air that's coming out. So, of course, they were highly regarded and treasured.
Yes, here's Rupert Neve actually talking about this himself in 2015. Let's listen.
You bring a bunch of musicians in and make a recording, and they find that the guitar is kind of lost. So what do? You bring all the musicians in again, scouring the various nightclubs and so on into which they've all disappeared over the last week, get them all together again, and re-record. Very expensive, difficult.
Right, because he's talking about prior to the 1970s, these mixing consoles were pretty simple, which made it kind of difficult to make improvements to a recording after the fact. This is where this idea of EQ or equalization was born. What is EQ and how did it improve recorded music?
EQ is to audio a little bit like filters are to a camera. So they allow us to make boosts or cuts to the frequency spectrum. It is the art of EQ that an engineer must master, especially back in the old days of analog tape, when you had to make those decisions straight onto the tape. These days, with digital audio, you can make those decisions after the fact. But back in those days, an audio engineer had to be a sound sculptor who could make those correct decisions in the moment when you have a band on the other side of the glass. So you need to capture that signal to the best of your ability, deciding which frequencies are going to overlap on others, which ones are going to stand out. You're painting the auditory picture, and the tool that you're mainly using to do that painting is your equalization, your capacity to sculpt the individual sounds after the source.
Back to the 8028, that soundboard really defined the sound of classic rock. I'm thinking Fleetwood Mac, The Grateful Dead, Santana, Pat Benatar, and so many others recorded with the Neve board. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers recorded their classic 1979 album, Damn the Torpedoes, on the Neve board at Sound City Studios. Let's listen to some of Don't Do Me Like That. You know, we can hear how big those drums are in the beginning of that song. Why was the Neve board so suited to rock and roll?
It was ideally suited to rock and roll. In fact, it was a little bit harder to use that console with dance music. With rock and roll, you don't need a pointy, sharp kick drum. With rock and roll, you can have that low kick drum. You can have that low fat bass. So for rock and roll, the Neve with its big, expansive low end was absolutely perfect. However, those low frequencies could be a little bit too much when doing dance music. Like, for example, with Prince, when I worked with Prince, the Neve would not have suited his sound because it was too much of a good thing. It was too much of that bottom that we didn't use in funk music and pop music in the 1980s. So record producers, recording engineers would choose a console based on the sound qualities that would serve them the best. The Neve just happened to be the one that served most record makers most of the time. It could pretty much do anything you wanted.
Oh, I'm learning so much. This is such an exciting conversation, Susan. You know, Dave Grohl actually owns that Neve board from Sound City. He bought it after the studio shut down. He says recording on that board during the sessions for Nirvana's 1991 breakthrough record, Nevermind, actually changed his life. As a recording engineer yourself, were there any moments in your career where working on a piece of music with equipment really made a piece of music shine?
Oh, yes. So a recording engineer is employing a running stream of decision-making. As your fingers are on that console and you're sculpting, you know what you want the sound to be, and you need this equipment to be responsive and to give you what you're looking for. It's no accident that Rupert Neve's designs were so beloved by so many. He must have been a musician on some level to understand musical instruments and to be able to make his console musical. So it responded like a musical instrument and was an essential part of the collaboration that we're all involved in when we make a record.
Yeah, that collaboration breeds magic. You know, all of the pieces coming together in that way. How does modern recording equipment measure up to these old Neve products, Susan?
Well, in today's world with digital audio, you've got virtually unlimited track space. So in the days when I worked in analog audio, we had 24 tracks, which meant that the record producer had to be a master arranger. So we were very limited. But today, you can have as many tracks as you want. Now, the other thing that the digital audio has done for us is something that's so bizarre to me because I'm from the older era. The output sounds like the input. The sound that goes into the recording device is exactly the same as the sound that comes out of it. I'm an older engineer, so in my era with analog tape, that was not the case. It was nonlinear. Everything in the studio, the console, the tape machine, everything was going to distort the signal in some way. We liked it. We wanted it. We wanted the machine to speak to us in a certain way with its own unique sonic characteristics.
Well, it really speaks to a moment in time and how Neve Products has really shaped a sound and shaped the experience for musicians.
Yes, and I'm fond of reminding students that just because a new technology has come along, it doesn't mean that the old ones have gone away. Of course, those tube microphones that we treasured back in the 1940s, they're still there, and they're worth a fortune today. So we picked up some new features, but we lost something in every stage. We lost a sound that we had become accustomed to. So every generation has to use the tools that they've inherited in the way that they see fit. But every generation, of course, has a greater range of tools to choose from. As long as we can keep those Neve consoles running, we will still have their sound for as long as we can do that.
That's Berklee College of Music professor Susan Rogers talking about the late audio equipment inventor Rupert Neve. He died earlier this month at the age of 94. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Today, a NASA rover spacecraft is scheduled to go where no spacecraft has gone before. It'll touch down in an ancient crater on Mars. Scientists hope to find clues as to whether life ever existed on Mars. If all goes according to plan, the rover called Perseverance will be the first to land on the red planet since 2012. We're joined now by one of the scientists who's behind that mission. Bryony Horgan is an associate professor of planetary science at Purdue University, and she joins us on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hello.
So this is a very exciting day, I think, for you and for a lot of people, in fact, who are going to be watching. Perseverance is going to be landing on the Jezero crater, the oldest terrain ever explored on Mars. Let me ask you first what this day is like for you.
Oh, it's incredibly exciting. You know, every landing is a huge event, but this one in particular is really meaningful. For me personally, it's the first big mission that I've been on, but also this mission is the culmination of decades and decades of Mars research. So everyone is incredibly excited.
So it's the culmination of decades of research to what end? It's a feat of engineering, and maybe you can tell us that, but what is the ultimate mission?
So we're actually looking for signs of ancient life on Mars. You know, we've been trying to understand where on Mars there could be life preserved. And we finally think after decades of orbiters and rovers on the surface, we really understand that well enough to go look for signs of ancient microbial life. So that's the goal of this mission, is to look at the rocks in Jezero Crater and try to find traces of ancient Martian life from billions of years ago.
Now, other rovers have landed on Mars, of course, but they have not landed on this crater. What is it about this ancient crater that makes you think you could find evidence that life once existed there?
So Jezero Crater, it's sort of a medium-sized crater on Mars, but what's really special about it is that it has this beautifully preserved delta that we think formed when this big river channel that cuts through the rim of the crater emptied out into this crater, forming a lake. And we think that delta contains the remains of the lake, all the sedimentary layers that were laid down. And those are on Earth. We know that these deltas are great places to look for signs of ancient microbial life. And so this ancient delta on Mars, we think, is one of our best shots of finding life on the red planet.
How old is that sediment?
So this sediment, we think, is about 3.8 billion years old. So that's back to, if you think about, you know, Earth at this time, that was back at the very dawn of life on Earth. And, you know, the rocks from that period on Earth are completely gone. They've just been totally eroded or destroyed by plate tectonics. So these are some incredibly special ancient rocks that we're going to be visiting on Mars.
And explain the mechanics of this. How will the Perseverance spacecraft access that sediment, those rocks?
So Mars has actually done a great job of exposing those rocks for us through, you know, billions of years of erosion. The delta has been eroded back, exposing this huge cliff in the front that we can drive right up to and see a whole huge record of the geology, you know, of these sediments that were laid down in the lake. So the Perseverance rover has a drill on board. It's a drill that will collect pencil-sized tubes of rock that we, you know, after we've established with the rover that these have a good sign of containing signs of ancient life, then we'll be bringing those back to Earth with a future mission that we're calling Mars Sample Return. And that will happen sometime in the next decade.
Well, I hate to say this, but that sounds a little disappointing, because with all the Perseverance can do, it can gather the samples, but it can't bring them back.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is the issue. It's actually incredibly hard to bring samples back to Earth, right? I mean, the sequence of events, it requires the Perseverance rover to characterize the site and, you know, identify the best samples, and then another mission to come collect those samples, bring them back to a launch pad where a rocket will launch them into orbit, rendezvous with the spacecraft that can then bring them back to Earth and land on Earth. So it's a lot of stuff for one little rover to do. And so it's a series of missions that both NASA and the European Space Agency are working together to make happen, again, sometime in the next 10 years.
And what will you find out in the meantime? Is there any kind of real-time education that will go on, either as you're watching later today Perseverance touchdown or through the period of 2 years that it's going to be there?
Yeah. So, I mean, for this mission with Perseverance, we're hoping to identify potential signs of life. And so we're hoping that by using the microscopes onboard the rover, as well as all of our, you know, cameras and amazing remote sensing instruments, that we'll be able to detect rocks that we think, you know, have potential signs of life in them. So things like, you know, textures from microbial mats that used to grow along an ancient shoreline, or detections of organic materials. We can do that with this rover. But to verify that, we really have to bring those samples back to Earth with Mars Sample Return.
And ultimately, what does it mean if you find out that there was life on Mars? What kind of life, first off, would it have been? And what does it matter?
So we're looking for microbial life. Again, if you think back to this period of time, 3.8 to 4 billion years ago on Earth, everything was microbial. We didn't evolve more complex forms of life on Earth until a few hundred million years ago, which on Mars was basically yesterday. But really, the reason that's so, so important, you might think, oh, you know, it's microbes. Why do we care, right? But really, it comes down to, we have no idea how common life is in the universe. And in my opinion, and in the opinion of NASA, you know, that's the biggest scientific question we can ask is, how are we alone? Is there other life out there? And the, one of the sort of simplest ways to get at that is looking at other planets in our solar system, in our backyard. If they ever supported any kind of life, even microbial life, that's a big indicator that life may in fact be very common in the universe. And, you know, a great stepping stone to thinking about, could we find other, you know, civilizations and things like that? But the first step is, are there microbes out there in our solar system? So that's really what this mission is trying to get at.
And what's the appropriate way to celebrate having a spacecraft land on Mars?
That's a great question. I don't know. I have a bottle of champagne chilling in the fridge.
It's a good way to celebrate anything. Thank you. Yeah. Bryony Horgan of Purdue University, a member of the Perseverance Mission Science Team. So nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.